black success has very little to do with being black. This new idea of taking it on yourself and driving that is key to success. Counterintuitive to the notions of black success, which is, oh, well, I'm only successful when I've actually beaten racism. That's when you're defined as successful. Whereas in fact, what I'm trying to say is that it's when you realize how to be free is actually within yourself. When you realize your own agency, that's when you get the success.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Tony Sewell. Tony, welcome to the show.
Great. I mean, thanks for having me. And, you know, it's a pleasure to be on. Spiked has been something I've followed, you know, over the years. And treat me gently, though.
Oh, I will. Yeah, well, we're fans of yours as well. We admire your work. And I want to talk to you about your new book, which is a rollicking read. Your new book is Black Success, The Surprising Truth. It takes us on all sorts of journeys. It takes us on a bit of a personal journey from in relation to your life, from Southeast London right through to the House of Lords and all the good stuff you've done in between in relation to education and improving the lot of underprivileged kids. So there's a lot of stuff packed in there from your personal journey, as well as, of course, a lot of social and political observations and questions and issues as well. So there's a lot to talk about. I think I wanted to start off by asking you, what moved you to write the book? Because even the title of it, Black Success, stands out in an era in which we are encouraged to see black people as institutionally oppressed and lacking in agency and constantly requiring the assistance of other people in society. Even the title of it is quite jarring, I think, in the contemporary period. So what was it that made you want to write this book and get those ideas out there?
I think one of the things was I'm always trying to do things a bit different. I want to try and be a bit of a disruptor in some ways. And I wanted really to go after that term because in some ways it's not controversial in the sense that people talk about black success generally. There's awards and things like this. I actually wanted to kind of go inside it and actually ask the question, what are the reasons behind black success? And then I said, am I really in this kind of category as well? And one of the things that was intriguing as I was writing was that in my own life and also the characters that I pick up and the movements I've been involved in is that black success has very little to do with being black. So there you have your kind of almost your nudge towards the audience to say, well, look, the reader say, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? This is not just, you know, a kind of roll call of great Black's achievements over the years. It actually is getting literally under the skin. And yeah, and that's what really happened. It was just, so the issue of race itself becomes problematic. And then really and truly, it's really pivoted on two things, agency and self-affirmation. And those were the two big things that drove it. So the Windrush is an example of one that we take apart in the book and come up with a different narrative for that. So that's essentially why black success is not exactly what it seems.
Yeah, and I want to get back into some of the details of what you mean by black success, how you measure it and why you think it's important to talk about it. One thing that I really liked about the book is that you actually say that the book and possibly your whole life has been about exorcising the ghosts of 1981. And that is a reference to the Brixton riots. Lots of listeners will be familiar with the Brixton riots. Some younger listeners may not be. Who knows? I have the vaguest memories of the Brixton riots. I was a very young kid at the time, but I do remember them. It was the only story in town for a very long time. And you write about them incredibly well. You write about your own personal experience of growing up nearby and having friends in the area and their experiences too. And I wondered, what do you mean by exorcising the ghosts of the Brixton riots of 1981? Why do you think that's an important period in black British history, I guess, for someone like you to have a reckoning with and to really try to see how things have changed since then?
Because really my generation, in a sense, I'm 64, and I think that I look and talk to people now. A lot of them haven't got over that, or said got over it, but that's maybe a bit glib to say got over. What actually happened in 1981 was that it was a reckoning for all young people, in a sense. But specifically, I'd say that if a white young person had it bad in 81, black person had it times 10. I do think, and it was really around those sus laws that really became the pivotal thing there. And I'm no denier of the reality of racism and its effect. It's there. It was there in my parents' experience. It's been there in mine. And you know, what the problem you always have with these things is that once you start trying to understand it in the more complex arena, people don't go with you. They think you're denying it. But that's, you know, we can talk about that. So what then happened was that because of those riots or uprisings or whatever you want to call it in a sense, it was really very much for the Caribbean population. The two things happened. I think my parents did have an encounter with the general white population, and in many ways that was negative, although in the book I show how they turned that to a positive. But I think for my generation, it was the encounter with the police, the day-to-day encounter with the police. I didn't really have that much myself, but everybody had a story, and it was notoriously bad. What happened is things changed and moved on as they would in history. So, for example, the world of Britain is a completely different place, irrespective of what has happened with police encounters, and it was in 1981. You wouldn't recognize it, yeah? And yet people still don't acknowledge it. Now, what probably has happened psychologically is that a lot of those people around still, you know, haven't got over that, or they haven't moved with that. And so it still hangs there. And also they kind of transfer some of that to their children and to their wider discourse. People are in power. You have MPs, but Bernie Grant, Diane Abbott, these people are in there, and they knew that period as well. And I wonder sometimes whether there is intrinsically a hypocrisy in some of that, because they do know that the world has moved on, but they still don't want to acknowledge it. So that's where that sits. So as you say, straight out of the blocks, I don't go to this sort of so-called post-racial world that we're, you know, it is right in 81 where it was the hardest, yeah? And so that's your starting point. Where are we now as a result of that base, you know? And that's what you've got to measure, you know? And why is it that a generation, some of them have found it difficult to move on? So what I'm actually trying to do in the book, almost, Brendan, and I don't see myself as a psychotherapist, but I'm actually maybe helping that generation a bit to say, well, look, this is how to be free, yeah? It's not really a struggle here in this sense now. It's kind of you guys realizing that how you be free is actually within yourself and for your children to realize that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the people who call you a racism denier have clearly not read anything you've ever written or listened to anything you've ever said, and we'll come on to the people who say that about you in a moment. But it's very clear that you're not a racism denier. And as you say, the book starts with what you describe as the terrible injustices that led to the Brixton riots of 1981, when there were extraordinary injustices faced by black kids and youths and families in London. And that exploded onto the streets. You touched on there, and I think it's a very interesting issue, about this idea that things haven't improved. And you mentioned Diane Abbott as one example, but I'm sure there are many others who must know that things have improved, who must know, as someone of your generation knows, that things in Britain in 2024 are not like things in Britain in 1981 for the black community and for other people as well. Do you think that kind of refusal to acknowledge advancements, which you also see in the American context as well, if you look at a writer like Ta-Nehisi Coates or many others, there is this idea that nothing has improved. And then you think to yourself, well, hold on, was the civil rights movement a complete waste of time? Did they make no gains whatsoever? So a kind of fatalism creeps in that nothing ever gets better, nothing ever improves. So what's the point? Do you think there's a danger there that if we continue making that argument, we will communicate to a younger generation that it's not even worth rising up or having a political campaign because nothing ever really gets better?
I think we could go even deeper than that. That's why I quickly start the thing with my mum's journey and her generation. And in fact, things were, even in the misery, even when it was tough, stuff was happening that was on a very positive line. So it's all in the language and it's all in the communication. People think that, for example, if you're facing the reality of some kind of disadvantage, that in fact, at the same time, you're actually powering along and doing well, that somehow one cancels out the other. So, but what happens is you can't have that going on at the same time. So it's not that things have improved so that it's completely gone away. The thing persists. but it's definitely not as worse as it was. So there's something going on, in, as you say, in this persistent narrative that can lock you in and not really then enjoy all the successes you should do. The other thing, which is linked to your question, is this thing about happiness. And I did a talk the other day at Oxford, and I said to the audience that I'm probably the happiest black man in the world. I started that off. And it was also about, like, it's a sin to be happy and to be content as a black person in Britain. Somehow you have to have some jeopardy. A black person appears on the TV. Oh, they're going to have some story about somebody who tripped them up. I haven't really, Brendan, got any of those stories for you. It's not that I didn't see or experience any of these races. They didn't hold me up. And worse still, this, my peers, this is what really hurt me. My white peers in my school definitely had a worse time than I had, in a different way. For you to say that, it's almost complete, you know, how can you talk about working class white kids having a worse time? But it was my experience. I mean, few of them did very well. And they did have some, a bit of white privilege. But essentially, between myself, my brother, we just drove ourselves straight through this thing. And, you know, that's it. You know, that was our experience.
I want to ask you also about how it's possible that some of the older black community in the UK has internalized some of the terrible experiences they had in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and maybe pass that on to their children, their grandchildren. You know, that could be one explanation for some of the culture of fatalism around black improvement and black success and so on in the UK. But you also mentioned in the book an issue that I find very grimly interesting, which is you talk about there is a culture at the moment often coming from well-meaning but patronizing white people, which says that black people have no control and no agency over their experiences, and that the system is inevitably stacked against them and always hostile to them. Now, I'm pretty sure every listener will know exactly the kind of culture you're talking about there. You know, there is this kind of, you know, guardianista type of person, you know, a well-meaning member of the liberal elite, often from a very middle-class white background, who will talk about, you know, the demonic force of structural racism and the terrible impact it has on black communities. And there is a moment, isn't there, where what thinks of itself as solidarity actually becomes a very paternalistic pity almost for sections of society, and even worse, projects the message that those sections of society can never really improve unless we, you know, the good white people, unless we give them a leg up. It poses as anti-racist, but it actually contains a bit of racial paternalism, some of that contemporary culture.
Let me give you a story that isn't in the book. Oh, it is in the book. I think it's there somewhere. Sometimes I can remember my book. When I was at university, over the 81 period, or near the end, and I did a play called Dutchman by Leroy Jones, which I advise everybody to go and read again. Yeah, it's only 60 pages, so you get through it quick. And Dutchman, Leroy Jones, is interesting. It's set in the subway in America, but what we did in our thing was we did it in a London Underground. And what it was is it's the interaction between Clay, which I played, and Lula, the white girl on the train. Essentially, what happens is I get on the train. So I'm sitting on the train, and then she gets on, and she has this apple. So there's an Adam and Eve sort of thing going on. She comes across and then basically says, because I'm wearing a suit and everything else, that somehow I'm this buttoned-up black man who's kind of an Uncle Tom figure who doesn't understand the reality of racism. And she says that in the end, you know, I mean, she goes on and on and on. But essentially what her message is exactly what you're saying, is that you really, in a sense, should be out there, you know, preaching against all this racism and how systemic it is. And then I turn around and I turn around and say, you know, it's really about you, isn't it? It's about you and your power. So in the end, as I lean across to her, she stabs me and then I die. They take me off. And then another black guy comes on. And so she's a serial killer. The black man who just wants to be himself. But essentially what you're saying is that there are Lula figures out there. I mean, men and women to a certain extent. What they don't understand is that they are actually killing your agency. Because that is the key in all of it. Because primarily they want the power. They want the say. I think this is where it gets kind of quite dangerous, you know. And I think that there are people that are difficult. But I must say this, Brendan, and I've shifted a little bit away from this. I am not absolutely sure that those people actually do control the whole kind of sense of what is in Britain. I think there's probably just a whole set of reasonable, ordinary people who may or may not read The Guardian. They're not invested in any of these things at all. For me, I think what I want my book to do is I'm kind of less interested in those Lula figures. I'm more interested in just talking to just ordinary people who've got no skin in the game, you know. It's quite interesting because the person who read my copy for spelling mistakes, an ordinary white guy, just read it. It's really interesting, his story. Because to me, he had the most powerful reaction to this book. He wrote to me offline and said, "Look, Tony, I'm just an ordinary white guy out in the up north here, and I'm just reading your book." And what he kind of understood was that there was a message for him in there as well, because this is not just about success for black people. It's also for anybody who is, in a sense, under this pressure of saying that the system is totally against you.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I want to invite you to my next very special live recording of this podcast. On Thursday, 21st of March at 7 p.m, I will be joined by the brilliant Matt Ridley, a science writer and the co-author of Viral, The Search for the Origin of COVID-19. Matt and I will be live and in conversation via Zoom, talking about the cover-up of the lab leak theory, the dire consequences of lockdown, the perils of net zero, and other things too. We'll also be taking questions from you, the audience, so if you have something you want to ask Matt, now is your chance. This is a free event exclusive to Spiked supporters, our online donor community. If you're already a Spiked supporter, you can sign up for your ticket now on our online donor hub. If you're not already a Spiked supporter, now is the perfect time to become one. For as little as £5 a month, you can get your ticket to this event, plus you'll enjoy loads of other exclusive perks like ad-free reading, access to our comments section, and to other free events like this one. To become a Spiked supporter, go to www.spiked-online.com/supporters. That's www.spiked-online.com/supporters. I'll see you there on Thursday, the 21st of March at 7 p.m. with Matt Ridley.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that comes through so clearly in the book that there is this kind of font of reasonableness in this country. And I think that book will strike a chord with lots of those people who have a, you know, very sane, reasonable, wise understanding of the society they live in and the real challenges that do exist and the other challenges that are invented and foisted onto us by people in positions of cultural influence. I think that really comes through well. And in fact, that brings me on to my next question. And I wanted to ask you, just to dig down a little bit into the question of black success and what you mean by it, because there's a really interesting strain in the book where you say the image of black success that we are most often exposed to is black sportsmen or sportswomen and black celebrities. So we have this sense that, you know, the successful black people are on the track and field, they're in the sports arena, or they're on the red carpet. And of course, there are political figures as well who've come from African heritage communities or Caribbean heritage communities. But that's generally the image we have of black success. But what you argue in the book really convincingly is that there is a whole other swathe of black success out there, which is, you know, maybe more ordinary, more everyday. You know, it's to do with attainment in exams. It's to do with home ownership. You know, Afro-Caribbeans in Britain have a large home ownership levels. It's to do with pay at work, you know, all these things that many people might see as mundane, but are actually very important markers of success for a community. So could you just say a little bit about how you understand black success in the real world, not just in these fantasy worlds that most of us will never get into?
I think the group that really does give us that in clarity, there are two groups. There's the Windrush group that gives us that, but I think that the new Nigerian group that arrives in Britain in around about 2000 in bigger numbers show this, because what they've pinned their success rate is it's almost where they've come from. So in effect, they haven't got the kinds of constraints or the kinds of influences that perhaps those of us who have a longer relationship with Britain, inside Britain, have. For example, I'm very interested to know how Nigerian communities go and live in places where back in the day we thought were very racist spots, but the housing price is just what drives them there. And they just go there and they just do their thing. You know what I mean? There isn't a historic link to a space. So they would occupy that. Also, I do think when it comes to education, they really do see the kinds of, I suppose, the opportunities. And that's what drives them. And I think there's some other factors involved in success that are determining it. For example, there's clearly a parallel between family and success. So that group in particular, the numbers are very clear, have less single parent situations than the Caribbean. I do think it's a factor because what happens is that their exam success is better than the white group, is better than the African-Caribbean group. And it seems to me that there is definitely a link between the fact that they have less single units than the Caribbean group does. And so the determinant for success isn't so much about race, because they're in the same classrooms as the Caribbean kids, but the outcomes are different. And so you can't have everybody blobbed up in one thing and saying this is black. It's very much a different outcome. The other thing that I suppose, in a sense, drives the success elements that are not always known are some of the cultural things as well. So in a Nigerian context or a West African context, the hierarchy, I mean, I say this with school kids, if you come from a hierarchical kind of family context where, for example, you might go home and granddad arrives from Lagos or whatever, and he's in the house, the first thing you do as a young Yoruba person or whatever, you would go prostrate down on the ground or go down on one knee as a symbol, as a ritual symbol of acknowledging that the elder is in the house, yeah? Your respect for older people, for hierarchies, for rituals are embedded in that culture. In the Caribbean context, we don't really have a lot of that, you know? It's very much relational. So a child would go to school and it's all this thing about, well, do I get respect from you? I'm only going to show respect unless you show respect. And that respect word, as you probably know, is constant. We're operating at 60% single parents. You know what I mean? So we can't deny that the black success relates to family structure and how that works. It's just a factor.
Yeah. That's another story that your book explains really well. And it's an argument you've been making for some time. And I find it convincing. And I want to come back to it in a moment. You know, that whole question of, you know, the disparities that exist in certain communities or the problems that exist in certain communities, there may be an influencing factor of racism, but there are so many other questions to do with family structure, focus on education, maybe even respect for elders and discipline. Where I grew up in Northwest London, I grew up with kids, most of whose parents were from rural parts of Ireland, and they were very disciplinarian parents. And we were always quite shocked by the English kids, as we refer to them, who seemed to come from sometimes from ill-disciplined homes. And there was always a bit of a difference between your world experience as a consequence. It's interesting that it would be seen as controversial to bring in precisely the kind of questions that you bring in this book and your other work, which is the questions of how are kids socialized? How are they brought up? Isn't it better if they have a father as well as a mother in the home? It's strange that those kinds of questions have come to be seen as very controversial, isn't it?
Because race is so dominant. And what my detractors will say is that, oh, Tony, you can't raise that. That's dividing and ruling the black community. When in fact, actually, it's more helpful because in policy terms or in terms of how you deal with different children, you then can produce things that would support those single parents or whatever it is that you're trying to target in terms of, you know, when I was a school teacher, one of the things that was quite clear to me was in these fraught family situations, it was good to bring in the different parents and get their perspectives. So you can then get behind some of the real issues instead of just this, oh, well, it's a political thing and it's divide and rule. And then, of course, back to your hypocrisy thing, some of this comes down to money as well. If you're a single black woman, maybe, and you've got a good career, etc., you may be able to finance some of this, you know. And so you kind of make the generalization that this is good for everybody, you know. Those families that need the support, you should be saying, well, look, okay, I'm doing well, fine, but other single parents may need some help. It's not a case. This is where it gets very sensitive, Brendan. And I do think that people don't get, and one refuse to get it because they think you're going after the single parent. There is some form here. Back in the day, I say back in the 70s as well, I think that there was a kind of blame the single mother sort of story narrative going on. And I think that that has carried on into our culture so that we're unable then now to really look at this in a more sophisticated way. So, you know, everybody was blaming the single parent, and that was wrong. It was more complicated than that. However, it's quite clear to me that it's back to this thing about Black success, that if you're going to really drive this success forward, you've got to have family structures that work.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I wanted to touch on some of the interventions that come from the top down to assist kids who are falling behind in various ways. And you describe really well in the book how some of those interventions can actually do more harm than good. So there's a really fascinating section on education, an area you know very, very well. You were a teacher, you've worked in the realm of education for a long time and educational improvement. And you've got this really great section where you talk about how some of the targeted programs, especially for Black boys in education, actually have the wrong focus. So they often focus on either tackling supposedly racist teachers. So it's about reprimanding the teachers who are seen as being unwittingly racist, perhaps, or it's about raising the self-esteem of Black boys as if they need some kind of, I don't know, therapeutic elevation, and then everything will be better. But what you say is that a better approach would be to set very high standards for Black boys as well as other kids, and also to focus on core knowledge. You know, what is the knowledge of society that ought to be transmitted to these younger generations through the education system? I fear that increasingly in some realms of education, the emphasis now is on making things relevant to the kid's own experience. So maybe Shakespeare is not relevant, apparently, to a kid whose ancestors are from the West Indies or who's black-skinned rather than white-skinned. And there is this attempt to bring education down to what I guess the educational blob sees as the ability levels of certain sections of society. And that really does actually sell out Black kids and other kids, doesn't it?
I mean, that's why I said the Black success thing is counterintuitive to the Blackness. So, for example, the whole notion that you must have Black history, you must have Black self-esteem programs, Black mentors, all these kind of things that, in a sense, have no proven really kind of record on outcomes. It can do marginal things, but what it does actually is help the people around it and the political people around it to feel that we're doing something political. And what it does also, it buys into this notion that the white teacher is a total demon. So one of the things is that, and I think this is the biggest one, that Black teachers are the answer to all the problems. So for example, if you have enough Black teachers in the classroom, it will make the difference. Now, believe me, it is not the color or the background of the teacher. It's the quality of the teaching. As you say, the expectations of those teachers. So, for example, in Hackney, where I worked in the Learning Trust, we did try out lots of these programs and they didn't move the dial. What we then ended up doing was, and I'll be very careful what I say here, I know it's going to go out, but we did end up doing two things. We went for, driven not by myself so much, by Mike Tomlinson and Alan Wood. They had a drive on high expectations. And Hackney was known as the worst education district, not in England, but in Europe. You know, it had that distinct kind of thing. And so they were left with, funny enough, from a Labour government, we were given this 10-year contract. And my bit was to go in and say, what do we do on the African Caribbean end, which was on the floor? And I think that we just said, look, we're going to get rid of some of these poor head teachers. They were crushing it for everybody. So it was a case of rising tides lift all boats. Then you had this great school, which was Mossbourne School, driven by Mike Wiltshire, which was the kind of, you know, the statement of the new academies, which were going to go forward. And his view was simply this, that you just drive that high expectation and it will deliver. But it was more than that. It wasn't just high expectations. I think what we also did in those schools was we had a program really where it was so forensic around the outcomes of those students, trying to drive every single child to these great results. All you had to do was homework, It was kind of expectation. It was very much driving the curriculum. And also we went for numeracy and literacy in the primary schools. Core things, tools that you had to win by. And I'll be honest with you, very little black stuff was done in the end. You know, I mean, and the outcomes were tremendous for African Caribbean students. And this is hard for people to get to grips with. I'm speaking to you, funny enough, I'm going to reveal where I am at the moment, but I'm actually in Jamaica at the moment. One of the things there is quite interesting. We have schools that have 98%, 99% teachers who look like me in the classrooms, and the education system for a lot of the poor kids is collapsing. And it's for these other reasons. It's not that the kids are not seeing teachers that look like them. They're getting that. The thing isn't working. So, you know, you're absolutely right. Is there something else about other than race that's driving this thing towards success or not success?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very well put. And there's another thing you touch on in the book in relation to some of the remedies that are put forward that might not be as useful as we think. And this touches on a point you made earlier as well about single parent families. So in the book, you refer to them as flaky role model schemes where you have, you know, role models are provided for black kids or other disadvantaged kids. And I'm sure these role models schemes have the best intentions. And I'm sure some of the role models who are provided, you know, the big brother style things that people do, I'm sure they're very good at what they do and I'm very caring people. But you do make the point in the book very well, I think, which is that a flaky role model provided to you by the state or the school or whoever just cannot take the place of a father figure. And as we've already said, that is a strangely controversial thing to say in this day and age. But anyone who grew up with a father, especially if they grew up with a good father, will know that it's true that they play an incredibly important role in a kid's life. In the book, you talk about how actually a father becomes more important around the ages of 11, 12, 13, especially with boys who are hopefully going to turn into gentlemen and be disciplined and in control and affirmative when necessary and so on. So just touch a little bit on that. How much do you think the absence of father figures in some kids' lives is a problem? And what might the solutions to that be? If role models don't work and often a father figure is absent, is there anything that can be done to plug that gap, or is it just a far broader problem?
Yeah. I'm going to be careful here because there'll be women listening to this who'll say, well, wait a minute, I'm in a single parent situation. You know, I've got a son or sons and they're doing very well. Thank you, Tony Saul. So, you know, you can't just make these generalizations about us, you know, and you're making, I hate categories of people and things like that. You've got to watch what those mothers are doing really in a sense. They're fairly resourceful around their boys and they're over it and they've got that drive. What clearly we're not doing enough of is looking at what does happen to too many boys in terms of the adolescent period, almost biologically, almost socially. And particularly the pressure that's on them is to do with the peer group. It's an enormous masculine thing, these rites of passages that we all go through as boys, you know, and it doesn't really matter. I know there's a range of masculinity, but there's so much evidence on this that, you know, young men go through a particular period. And we know this because you only have to look at our youth justice system. I used to work on the youth justice board. And believe me, we only locked up a few kids, but I'll give you the number, Brennan. I got the number in my head. It went at the time, it was 897 kids we locked up. And there were three girls. Only three girls were locked up in the whole of the youth justice system. So clearly something is going on here. So if you look at the negativity area, and I'm saying that girls don't have issues, it could be on a different level, but those numbers, how do you actually then get those boys to get some of that biological stuff that's inside them into a kind of way of tracking it so that it's useful and purposeful rather than negative? Now, what I had from when I was teaching was mothers coming up to me saying, I can't control him. That was the words. I cannot control him. I don't know. His dad's not here. I cannot control the situation. Help me, please. Yeah. Now, if you're somebody in the garden, whoever you're writing about this, say Tony is trying to put a stereotype on single mothers. So, no, they want help. And we're denying them the help because of the politics. Of that 897 boys in that youth justice system, 98% of them are from single parents, without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's something that absolutely needs to be talked about in the kind of way you do in the book, which is sensitively and with all the right information and with some very good ideas too. I want to fast forward to events of the past couple of years. And you make this really good contrast in the book, which really struck me, between the uprising of 1981, the Brixton riots, as they are recorded in the history books of 1981, and then the George Floyd fallout and riots and protests of 2020, which were global. This was a police killing that happened in the US, but the protests, of course, were global. And you talk about some of the protests in the UK, and you make this really interesting observation, which is that where the Brixton riots were very much rooted in injustices in Britain that were facing Black Britons, the protests of 2020 were about something else, something much further away, events that we don't really have any control over. And you also make a contrast between the Afro-Caribbean youths who made up the uprisings of the 1980s, especially 1981, the young people involved in the 2020 protests, who were very often white, or kids who are about to go off to university and get a good degree and maybe get a good job in the future. I mean, it's so very, very different. What do you think those differences tell us about how anti-racist politics has changed? Because it does seem to be an interesting shift from anti-racist politics as something a bit more forceful and political and focused, as it might have been in the 80s, not to be too Pollyanna-ish about the 1980s or anything like that, and anti-racist politics today, which often seems, as we've been saying, quite paternalistic. It's often led by upper-middle-class white people, upper-middle-class Black people. Between 1981 and 2020, what do you think tells us about how that has changed?
I think that for me, I would look at the class differences, because we were really poor in those days. You know, I remember that university entrance, 2% of the population went to university. However, it was you could get free education. You could get all your books paid for. It was great if you got in, but only 2% went, you know. So whereas obviously when Blair came along, 50%, a big shift. Although that, in terms of the Black population, those students going to the top universities are still low. What I suppose you've got really is a difference in the shift of a politics that says that basically, even though it's not in my experience, and it could be that I encounter police or whatever, it's very much a political identity kind of thing going on here, which I don't think we had in 81. I think what we had was, there was not much food. I must remember everybody was skinny in the 1970s. There's nothing to eat. I mean, and then at the same time, you had this overt racism that was coming to you in the 70s. It was just so overt. You couldn't miss it. It was just right in you. So you had all of that. And then this, I make the distinction between the Diana Ross song, which was coming out. And I always, maybe my ears, I always thought she said coming up, but it's actually coming out. So what happened was that when I watched on the TV and watching this, these kids who were fairly middle class, really, on these protests, yeah? Nothing like what we had in our day. And it was St. Martin's in the Fields, the kind of up the steps. And this guy was playing the song, going up the steps. And I thought, no, what you wanted to do was talk about not coming out, but coming up, because coming up is about social mobility. That's the new challenge that we face now in Britain, how to actually go into STEM, how to get a better job, how to kind of get yourself out of poverty. Not this, I'm coming out, I'm more Black than you, or whatever it is, or I've read this book in America, and so therefore I found myself, as it were. Well, you want to find a job, you want to find a career. And so the challenge was then, that means you have to get qualifications. That means, so it's a much more pragmatic kind of thing, I think, that coming up is about, rather than coming out is this more and more identity stuff, which I don't know whether it takes us anywhere, really. It tends to be very circular and it lands in so many different areas. And I think the other thing about the identity thing is that it doesn't allow for what I think is essentially the most important thing, is it's so anti-British. These are British-born young people who have no pride in actually where they're born. so that your identity is outside, it's somewhere else. It's this decolonization project. Whereas in fact, maybe that, you know, if you did take a look, you know, there's so much that is actually positive in your experience, but you're not seeing that because you're taking down this other journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is one of the key problems with identity politics, which is not only that it is divisive very often, splitting people into different fixed groups, but also that it encourages this sense of loathing, really, for one's own society.
The loathing of the Britishness, the two things are linked. You loathe the country, you loathe yourself. It actually is not the case in the United States. African Americans actually do like being American. Believe me, they might tell you that, but they are. And I think sometimes primarily they're, even the poorer ones, they are America first in inverted commas, you know. Whereas here, I get a sense that people are still kind of skeptical about being British and claiming that. And I think that's the thing that I want to challenge, that Black success really in the end is about embracing that. So in fact, taking Shakespeare for yourself, he's yours. It doesn't belong to white people. It belongs to everybody. If you believe in this human condition, that the unity is yours, you know, and not telling somebody, oh, he's got to be replaced by somebody else.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show.
Yeah, I always think of the great line from W.E.B. Du Bois, who said, I sit with Shakespeare and he winces not. And, you know, that's a message you want to get through to today. You know, Shakespeare is for everyone. And those universal beliefs and universal ideas are far preferable, I think, to the identitarian stuff that we've seen recently. Tony, I just wanted to ask you, just to draw it to a close, I wanted to ask you about the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities. This is a major thing that came out of the events of 2020. You were commissioned by Boris Johnson's government to chair this commission and to look at, are there race and ethnic disparities in Britain and what are the causes of them? And you write about this in your book. So anyone who's interested in the commission and what happened with it should absolutely read your book as well. And you made it very clear in the report of this commission that there are still disparities between different groups in society. That's a bad thing. But then not all of them can be explained by racism. And that it's worth thinking about what can be done to address those disparities, how we can understand them, and whether, even though racism still exists, can we call Britain an institutionally racist country? So it was a very interesting report. I think it was appreciated by lots of ordinary people out there. But you will know, of course, there was a vicious reaction from sections of the establishment and the commentariat. You were compared to Joseph Goebbels at one point. What did you make of that fallout from the commission? Were you shocked by it? Because it seemed, even to me, who's used to seeing these kinds of debates playing out in a pretty crazy way, seemed to me to be, even by those standards, it was really over the top and really vicious at certain points. What did you make of it?
What I made of it was quite interesting. People now read, if they bother to read it, because that's the other thing, a lot of people didn't read it. But what was interesting was that, to be honest, the report was very, very reasonable. It wasn't as if it was like on the extreme of anything. What actually was happening was that people were reacting prior to the report, because I got a lot of this stuff before I wrote anything, yeah? And the politics around that was very clear, and I got this from Guardian journalists who I know, is that because it was commissioned by Boris Johnson, they said that they were going to go after this irrespective because it was him that was the commissioner of it. And I do think that that politics played into this. So you already had people already ganged up against it before a word was written. And I think what then happens with these things is that you come up with something that just follows the data. What they wanted you to say, and this is another thing, Brendan, that people they don't want to hear this, but we never did say institutional racism. We didn't deny that it existed in the report. We mentioned it, but with nowhere in the report, anywhere does it say that institutional racism doesn't exist. We didn't say it did exist and there's all this evidence for it, but we didn't deny it. And this is where the journalists kind of have to take a lot of blame. They just wanted to run with this caricature the report against something else. And I think that's really where the problems for the communication of the report happened, that people had already made their mind up and they were going for it. The other issue in the report, this is much more positive, is that there were so many recommendations in there that dealt with the structural racism in the society. There's a whole list of them that was totally ignored. So everybody was drunk on George Floyd and all these other things, black screens and everything else. And people were just rushing to cancel or condemn anything that didn't seem to go along with that line. Yeah. And I think that duly a lot of people are embarrassed by this, because if you look at it, very, very reasonable. In fact, to be honest, I think we should have gone a bit further in some of the things, but we didn't, you know. And so I think that that's there. But for me, one of the key outcomes of the report for me was it did land in this whole area of geography. There's some recent report that's just come out about Wales saying that post-16 outcomes in Wales are the worst in the country at the moment. The problem we had in the report was that because everybody was invested in this old idea that if you are black, you just have the worst outcomes on every single level. They wouldn't allow for any other variation on the theme. So, you know, in England, basically, the mortality rates for white people are much higher than black people. In the health service, for example, there is, in terms of employment, 40% of those people working in the health service are doctors of an Asian background, you know. And what the report did was tear up this whole idea of BAME, this whole idea of black, Asian, minority, ethnic. The outcome of a Bradford taxi driver from a Muslim background is a world away from the life and the outcomes of an Indian doctor in Harrow, you know, yet they're categorized as the same thing. So what we did, we broke that all up, we disrupted it. And I think that what that report should be looking at, and left and right should see it as a disruptor of the narrative. That's what you've got to see it as. Boris Johnson had nothing to do with my outcome on my report. He commissioned it and then signed it off at the end. And that was good for him that he did that. He wasn't behind it or anything like that. But the politics of it was the reason why we were held to their strange fire. And I think that that's a shame on our journalistic community. You should know better.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think disrupting the narrative was essential. And especially, as you say, in relation to the idea of BAME, B-A-M-E, you know, because I think the useful thing about disrupting an idea like that is precisely that you can bring in the different class experiences that people have in society, the different family experiences, the different community experiences. And I remember a day long, long ago when the left would have welcomed the reintroduction of class differentials, community differentials. These are important things to understand and to talk about. Okay, Tony, my last question for you is just on the question of agency. You talk about agency a lot. It's one of my favorite words. I think agency is a very good thing. I do worry that we live in an era of anti-agency. People are encouraged to not take responsibility for their lives or their decisions, to play the woe is me card and to see themselves as victims and as always in pain and suffering from the pain of history and the pain of the past experiences. You know, they're encouraged to see themselves as lacking agency. I think some people embrace that as a bit of a comfort blanket because then they don't have to take charge of their lives. So there is a real problem going on there. So I just wonder what you think society can do to help restore agency, or is that a contradiction in terms? Is there a danger that if we build too much scaffolding around people to try and make them more aware of their agency, that we actually undermine their agency? How do you think we get that balance right?
Let me give you, I'll try to in this talk give you things from real examples. Take young people. I just think that part of the education system should be, and that's what you do get in some schools, a good one, is to teach children, it might be a contradiction here, teach children how to have agency. Yeah. So, for example, I did a program called Learning to Succeed I got funding from a teacher union, NSWT fund. They've gone to the left now. I don't know what's wrong. But the problem we had in some of those schools back in the sort of mid-90s was still this issue of African Caribbean boys doing badly. So what we tried to do is to say, look, okay, how about getting the children to manage your teachers rather than the teachers manage you? So we came up with these three skills that we taught the kids. One was the giving it skill. Now, that is where you're down the corridor. The teacher's calling you out, but he's called the wrong person. So the teacher then blasts you. Now, the normal reaction would be that the kid goes back to the teacher and they haven't got the power. So straight to the head teacher and then they get excluded. So what we did a before and after thing with film. So we taught the kids how to do the giving it. Then there was the taking it skill, how to take the stuff. And then, of course, their interactions with each other. They couldn't work out their differences. The word your mum or whatever came up would then immediately cause violence. So how do you work that all out? They loved it. We made these films and they did the before and after. And then they said, right, go and try that out on your teachers. Yeah. Now, a lot of the teachers didn't like what we were doing in the schools, but the head teacher allowed this to happen. And we did it in about 10 schools. And believe me, Brendan, the rate of African Caribbean exclusions did go down. I must admit, there was one example where it didn't work, where I remember this girl. She's actually now at Oxford. Well, at that time, she was at Oxford. She's now working in a big corporate. But by the time I saw her outside the head teacher's office, I said, Jennifer, what are you doing out here? And she said, well, Dr. Saul, I tried to give it its skill. Then I tried to take it out. Then I tried to work it out. Then I got confused. So I just told the teacher to fuck off. It didn't work. However, I'd say that with that caveat, back to your point about agency, that in fact, teaching the children how to manage their institution, it's not a cop-out. It's not to say that the schools or the teachers are not racist or that there's not problems inside the school. But this new idea of taking it on yourself and driving that is key to success, counterintuitive to the notions of Black success, which is, oh, well, I'm only successful when I've actually beaten racism. That's when you're defined as successful. Whereas, in fact, what I'm trying to say is that it's when you realize how to be free, when you realize your own agency, that's when you get the success.
Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.